I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoze, co-founder of La Bernardin, a leading seafood restaurant in New York City. Maggie started La Bernardin in 1986 with her brother Gilbert after operating the restaurant with the same name in Paris. When Gilbert died from a heart attack in 1994, Eric Repair took over as the restaurant's co-owner and chef. Maggie and Eric are co-authors of La Bernardin Cookbook. La Bernardin has been awarded 3 Michelin stars and has held 4 stars from the New York Times since it opened. Welcome.
Thank you.
What are your earliest memories of eating fish?
Oh, from the very beginning, I didn't like meat. So that was easy. When I was very young, 3-4 years old, I was eating in the dining room in our little hotel restaurant in Brittany with my brother, and we were eating fish.
So you lived in Brittany, and your parents operated a small hotel restaurant. How involved were you in the restaurant? What roles did you have?
We were involved very early, like peeling potatoes. We were stuffing clams. We were 7 or 8 years old. I was in the dining room with my mother, and my brother was in the kitchen with my father. And then my father had this idea, as he had 2 grown-up kids, to open a disco.
Tell me about the disco. This is now in the 1960s?
Yes, and it was one of the first disco in Brittany, so we were very successful, but we didn't know how to make money. And then later on, my brother was in his early 20s, he was working as in a disco in Paris. And then he really learned how to make money.
What kind of music played in the disco at the time?
The music of the Rolling Stone.
And your grandfather was a fisherman. Do you recall going out with him to catch fish?
Not me. I didn't like too much going on the boat, but my brother really liked doing that. And he preferred to go on the boat with my grandfather than to go to school, to tell you the truth. He was very young when he started to go on the boat with him. And one day there was a tempest that raised very quickly, and they had to tie him up with ropes to prevent him to be thrown away off the boat.
Did you both know from the early days that you wanted to go into business together and open a restaurant together? How did that happen?
Not at all. I wanted to be a stewardess, and my brother wanted to work on boats, but the kind of big boats where they go far away.
Cargo?
Yes, cargo.
Why did you want to be a stewardess?
Because I wanted to get out of Brittany and travel. That was it. I knew early in my life that I would not stay in Brittany. It was too remote, and I knew that there was a life somewhere else.
Eventually, you and your brother moved to Paris.
Yes.
But before opening the restaurant, you dabbled in different areas for a few years. What are some of the things that you did?
I modeled for a couple of years. Then I was a receptionist in an hotel. Then I was hostess in a restaurant. And every year, we would come back to Brittany to help our parents.
How did you both then make the decision to open the restaurant?
Because there was nothing else that we knew. We didn't know that it was going to be so difficult, because the small training that we had in that small hotel restaurant was not enough to make a success in Paris. So we opened that restaurant in Paris in 72 with the help of everyone, friends, family, loan at the bank. It was a disaster. We didn't know how to run the restaurant to make money. We were having fun being outside every night after when the restaurant was closed. And several times we thought that we would had to file for bankruptcy.
Your restaurant was almost taken away at one point.
That's right.
What is the story behind that?
One day I went for whatever reason to the market with my brother. And we came back with the small car full of fish, and we saw a notice on the window, for sale. This is our restaurant, this is us. It said, so I called the number and a man came. He said, all right, young lady, I'm going to help you. Can we sit somewhere? I said, yes, please come to my apartment. It's above the restaurant. He said, I'm going to help you. We can just take a lean on your furniture. What do you have? Here, I have one table, which is my desk, and two chairs. And I have my bedroom. I have my bed, and that's it. He said, that's the only thing I cannot take. So it's to show you how difficult it has been.
But despite this difficulty initially, you were actually opening a restaurant at an auspicious moment. Your brother, who was a chef with no formal training, benefited from a new experimentation going on in the French culinary community at the time. What impact do you think that had on your brother's cooking?
It was the beginning of the nouvelle cuisine. He tried to have some imagination. All the chefs were trying new way to get out of that heavy French cooking. So it was, in a way, the right time. He became friendly with all the chefs of his generation, went to have dinner with them, started to travel with them. They were always invited everywhere in France, whether it's to taste the truffles that were coming out or to taste wine. That's when everything started to come in his mind, I suppose.
And the first restaurant was called Le Bernardin.
It was called Le Bernardin, yes.
What does that mean?
It is a song that our father was singing to us called Les Moines de Saint Bernardin. Those monks were well known for the good life. They liked to eat and to drink. And that first location was on the left bank, not far from the restaurant that we were going to open. So we named the restaurant after those monks.
So you're talking about monks in a monastery? There is a monastery,
yes,
close to you? And monks obviously are known for their asceticism.
Yes, not those one.
I see. And so your father would sing this song to,
yes,
you growing up?
Yes. It's a well-known song.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoz, co-founder of Le Bernardin, a leading seafood restaurant in New York City. Maggie started Le Bernardin in 1986 with her brother, Gilbert. You operated the Paris restaurant from 1972 to 1987 in two locations.
Yes.
And the impetus for your closing the restaurant in Paris was that you opened up a New York restaurant.
Exactly.
In 1986.
Yes.
Why did you decide to move to New York?
It's very difficult to say because I didn't know New York. It's out of the blue. I was pushed by I don't know what or who, but it was very strong. And I started in the 1980 already to think about New York. I came once with my brother and we stayed 2 weeks. And my brother said, there is nothing here. There is no good vegetable. There is no herb. There is nothing. We cannot open a restaurant. And I told him, you are a coward. But he said, no way. We are not ready. And this town is not ready. We cannot do it. So a few years later, I told him, I don't want to stay here all my life. You will be 50 years old with a big belly behind your stove, and I will be with white hair at the entrance. I told him, I don't want a family, I'm not interested. I just want to run another business.
So you're eager to open a restaurant in New York, your brother not so much. What next? You tried a few times to start a restaurant, but investors repeatedly fell through.
It took me several times. One time I thought that I had everything. I had 10 different investment partner friends. And at the last minute, there was always one who would say no. And 1 year, I came back and I had almost a nervous breakdown because a deal didn't go through.
And then finally, a partnership randomly came together with essentially a stranger in New York City.
You met Mr. Holloway, who was the head of Equitable.
Yes, he was the chairman of Equitable.
And Equitable is the real estate company that owns the building that you've been in.
Yes.
How did you meet him?
We met him through a friend of mine whose brother was a very good friend of Ben Holloway. And he knew that he was finishing that huge building on the west side, which was not at that time a very well-known location.
155 West 51st Street.
So we went to his house. We opened a bottle of Dom Pérignon. We shook hands, said, that's it, we have a deal. Do you have an architect? Yes, we do. Tell your architect to get in touch with the architect of the building tomorrow. Do you have a lawyer? Yes, we do. Tell your lawyer to get in touch with the lawyer of the building and let's work on him. I said, but we don't have a deal. He said, we'll work on that. So they started to build the restaurant. We signed the deal 6 months later. He had so much trust and confidence with us that he knew that we were going to do it.
What was the restaurant landscape at the time in that neighborhood in Midtown?
It was not a good neighborhood. At night, we had some of our employees who were mugged. Nobody thought that it could be a right location. And we thought that it was going to be a right location because we were next to Rockefeller Center and next to Broadway.
But it was kind of accidental that you launched in this neighborhood.
Yes, that's right, because we had a very good deal.
How did you get financing from the beginning? Even you had Equitable as your landlord.
Yes.
But did they provide the capital to get the restaurant off the ground?
It was a turnkey operation.
A turnkey operation?
Yes, meaning that they would do all the work and then buy table, chairs, china, glassware, everything.
Lucky you.
Yes.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoze, co-founder of Le Bernardin. We'll hear more from Maggie coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoze, co-founder of Le Bernardin, one of the country's leading seafood restaurants. Maggie started the New York restaurant in 1986 with her brother Gilbert, and Le Bernardin received 3 Michelin stars and 4 stars from the New York Times as soon as it opened. She partnered with celebrity chef Eric Rappaire after Gilbert died in 1994. The restaurant changed its decor to produce a more contemporary feel in the autumn of 2011.
Now, your brother came to New York kicking and screaming because it
yes.
was your wish. Did you ever think that maybe you and your brother should part ways because you wanted to be in New York and he wanted to be in Paris?
Well, no, we were very, very close and that was enough.
Your brother was protesting that there are no good herbs and no good vegetables. Where did he find or where did you both find the produce and the fish for your restaurant in Midtown?
The good thing was that New York is on the water, so Gilbert figured out that some fish were going to come to New York. He just had to find where to find them. He went to the Fulton Fish Market, was the first restaurateur ever going to the fish market. That was very interesting because he made the fish market discovered by the journalist who came with him, and then the TV went with him to the fish market, and suddenly the fish market has been known, and then the fishmonger was happy to be on TV, so we were treated very well with them.
So your brother brought publicity to Fulton Fish Market
yes.
because journalists and the TV crew would follow your brother.
Mm-hmm.
Now, your brother did not speak English very well.
Gilbert didn't speak English. So his way to connect with them was just pointing out the fish and just pointing out the fish that they wanted to sell, which is no good. He said, he would say, no, no good. And that was it. And after a while, they understood that he really knew how to choose the fish.
So your brother was an expert in fish thanks to his family upbringing.
Yes, thanks to my grandfather, who was the fisherman.
And when you were first launching the restaurant in 1986, what were some of the challenges that you faced?
We could not find waiters. So we took our maitre d' from Paris with us, and the dining room became a school for 1 month. And we had at that time the biggest kitchen in New York. We had the first page of the New York Times with a picture of the kitchen. And we were serving dinner every night in the kitchen to train the waiters. And then we started to train waiters in the dining room, like having just 5 or 6 tables and increasing every day. And we had no publicity, no public relation to help us. Just people would see that there was light and that the Bernardin, they heard that the Bernardin was opening, and they would knock at the door and say, when are you going to be open? We said, we don't know when we will be ready. And one night, Gilbert said, okay, we'll be ready soon. Maggie, you get 50 people in the dining room and nothing else for 1 month.
Do you remember what was on the menu the first night when you opened?
We had raw fish on the menu. Nobody in New York had eaten raw fish except in a few sushi places. So I would take the order at the table with the maitre d' and convince people to try to take the raw fish. And I would say, please, try it. And if you don't like it, we'll give you something else. There was a lot of tuna in New York. And the tuna, when it's too cooked, it's not good at all. So I said to my brother, listen, why don't we serve it raw? So we had carpaccio of tuna. We had some raw fish marinated that we serve on green salad. We had sea urchin, which was not very popular. So we had a sea urchin in a butter of sea urchin. We had oyster, of course. We had oyster with truffle, which was very unusual as well. We had fish soup. We had skate.
Squid.
Yes. We had served monkfish, which was not very well known either, that we would serve with leeks.
All that on the first night?
Oh, yes. When we were ready, we were ready. And every week, I would increase a little bit.
Now, your responsibilities were always split between your being in the front of the house and his always being the chef. Did you ever try to cook yourself?
No, I never tried because I never had the opportunity. That was not the tradition in the 50s and 60s to have women in the dining room. It was women in the front and men in the kitchen.
You mentioned that your brother had no traditional training and
That's
that
right.
He was really more of an artist and he used his imagination. How did that help him in the kitchen, do you think, versus having a formal training?
Because our food was different, was very light. There was some broth, then emulsion.
Emulsion.
Yes. Spice with herbs. His menu was simple, but that's what was important because then really people started to appreciate the fish. And the fish was so fresh that it was really good.
You mentioned green salad, that you served fish on top
with
of green salad.
Yes. Oh, that was a big deal.
What was Gilbert's relationship with salad?
Oh, a nightmare. Because we had customer coming and asking for a green salad. And he says, no, we are not serving green salad. I said, why not? Because you are in the restaurant, it's a fish restaurant, and I don't go to the fish market every night to serve a green salad. That was it. We would not serve green salad.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoz, co-founder of Le Bernardin, one of the country's leading seafood restaurants. Maggie started the New York restaurant in 1986 with her brother Gilbert, and Le Bernardin received 3 Michelin stars and 4 stars from the New York Times as soon as it opened. The restaurant changed its decor to produce a more contemporary feel in the autumn of 2011. Incidentally, when exactly did you open the restaurant to the public?
The restaurant was ready by November 1985. We knew that it was not the right time to open in the middle of the season, but we opened in January, which had always been successful for us. All the restaurants that we opened in January.
What were some of the mistakes you made in the early days of the restaurant?
I don't think we made mistakes. We were strong enough not to open the restaurant and to accept a lot of customers the first 2 months. So when Gail Green, who was the first person who reviewed the restaurant, came, the restaurant was ready. Her friends was telling her, you must go to the restaurant, it's really good. She said, I promised them not to go before they tell me that they are ready. So finally she came, and Brian Miller came right away.
Brian Miller of the New York Times.
Yes.
Which gave you 4 stars.
4 stars, which was a big deal for him because it was at the beginning of him being at the New York Times, and it was the first 4 star that he gave. In his first article that he did, he said, I wish that we can take their passport so that they don't go back to France. And suddenly we were overwhelmed with the phones. We couldn't answer the phones. We had 5 persons on the reservation, and it was not enough. We had to buy a sophisticated answering machine to take over. Nobody could reach us. It was very special. It was special days.
When you got your 4 stars from the New York Times,
yes.
Do you remember that moment when you found out?
Yes, we found out because by coincidence, we had that night friends coming from France, and I said, you arrive right on time. Tonight we are going to see what we are going to get with the New York Times. The manager came at that moment with plenty of New York Times in his hands and threw away the newspaper in the restaurant.
The manager threw the newspaper in the air.
Absolutely. And in the private room, we had a reservation. It was 15 people. And they were all people from the New York Times. They all came down the stairs, and everybody was applauding.
Oh.
And everyone in the restaurant started to understand. So everyone started to applaud, and it was really a wonderful moment. And then we went outside to celebrate. When we came back, we called our father and explained him. And he said, so, you didn't go to the Fulton Fish Market this morning, my son?
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoz, co-founder of Le Bernardin, one of the country's leading seafood restaurants. Your brother, Gilbert, passed away in 1994 from a heart attack?
From a heart attack, yes.
Was it sudden? Was it?
Yes, it was sudden, but not really. A year before, he had a kind of small attack. At night, he woke up and his girlfriend, she rushed him to the hospital. And 3 days later, he asked the maître d' and Eric and the manager to come to the hospital with the mail, and in front of them he took all the tube that he had in his hand. He said, I am fine, and don't say anything to my sister or you will be fired.
So he took out all the tubes, all the needles and tubes from the hospital?
Yes. If I had known, I would have battled and fight with him so that to do the test. He was supposed to do tests that he never did.
So your brother kept his heart attack a secret so you wouldn't worry and force him to undergo a series of tests.
Yes.
Eric Repair, your now chef and co-owner,
yes,
came on board, took over in 1994 when your brother passed away. Eric had been working in the kitchen with Gilbert.
With Gilbert, yes.
What was that relationship like?
Gilbert was very friendly with Jean-Louis Paladin, a very well-known chef who was running a restaurant in the Watergate Hotel in Washington. He's the first French chef who came to United States. And Gilbert asked him if he had someone that he could recommend because he knew that that could not go further than what he has done, that he really need new blood. And Jean-Louis Paladin introduced him to my brother. And Eric, it took like a few months before Eric accepted it. They were meeting every Saturday at breakfast and talked about everything. They became friends before they became the chef of the restaurant.
Now, Eric's style of cooking is very different from your brother's. Gilbert was more ad hoc and there was no formal education, whereas Eric is well-schooled.
Oh, yes. Eric has the best training.
How is that manifested in the menu? How is the menu different as a result of now having Eric on board versus Gilbert?
When Gilbert died, I said to Eric, Eric, we have to stop. Don't do it at all, anything that Gilbert was doing, except the raw fish. We'll keep that, and everything has to be new.
How come?
Because I wanted to really to show that I should no longer think of my brother, and that Eric was a chef, and that he was talented, and that I wanted to show his talent.
I could see it going the other way. I could see some owners saying, I want you to continue in my brother's tradition. So it was probably freeing for Eric to have that
yes.
license from you.
Yes, definitely.
When the reviewers came to review the restaurant under Eric's auspices,
yes.
what were the
It was Ruth Reichel in 1995.
And?
4 stars.
4 stars.
Yes.
New York Times. Are you tearing up because this
yes.
is emotional for you?
Absolutely. It's 40 years of my life. But I have Eric and I. We are very close. We are like friends. I consider him like more than a business partner. He's my family. He's like my brother in a sense.
And Eric is really the public face of the restaurant to some degree. The star of a TV series called Avec Eric,
yes.
and a judge on Top Chef. How do you feel about his taking on that role with the restaurant, whereas you're more not behind the scenes because you're in from the front of the restaurant, but you certainly don't have your own TV series and you're not the one that has as much fame as he.
It's wonderful. I can go away whenever I want. And nobody is asking for me. Everybody is asking for Eric. It doesn't make a difference if I am there or not because I have a computer everywhere I go. I do the administration work in the restaurant. So every day I speak with everyone and I look at the numbers and that's fine.
Now, how has your job changed from the inception, from 1986 when you opened to now? What does your job entail?
In 1986, I was in the front. I was at the podium greeting people and then going to one table to the other, seeing if everything was fine. Mm-hmm. And then I would be in the restaurant from 6 o'clock to midnight, saying goodbye to the last customer. Plus the work in the office, it was very long days.
How has your clientele's taste changed from the beginning of the restaurant's opening till now?
They are very sophisticated now, yes. I don't remember, but what I can tell you is in one night we could have 15 tables taking tasting menus with wine pairing. So it means that the clientele is really sophisticated. They know about food.
There are so many restaurateurs expanding and having 2, 3, 5, 10 restaurants, whether they're all in New York or in other states. How come you're sticking with Le Bernardin only?
This is our choice. We like to be unique. When the customer comes, we want that experience to be very special. We always manage to be in the restaurant, either Eric or me, so that the customer can have that special experience. If they want to meet with us, we are there.
What is your diet like? What did you eat for breakfast this morning?
I eat cornflakes with skim milk, grapefruit that the restaurant prepare for me, and Greek yogurt. And lunch, it's green salad with vegetables and fruits.
How often are you eating in the restaurant?
Every day, lunch and dinner. And dinner, I pick up everything from the menu. I taste everything. And I sit down in the dining room, and I want to be served like a customer. That's where I see the details.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Maggie Lacoze, co-founder of Le Bernardin. Coming up, we'll meet John Oringer, founder of Shutterstock. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is John Oringer, founder of Shutterstock, an online marketplace for images, video clips, and music. The content is crowdsourced, with photographers, artists, and other contributors uploading their content in exchange for a percent of revenue when their work is purchased. John started Shutterstock in 2003, and the company went public in 2012. John lives in New York City, where Shutterstock is headquartered. Welcome.
Thanks.
You grew up in Scarsdale, New York. What do your parents do?
My dad was a science teacher, New Rochelle. My mom taught special ed in Yonkers.
And how would they describe you?
I think I was a curious kid. I was constantly taking things apart, putting them back together, trying to build stuff. I was always interested in how things worked. And once I started learning how to code, started to realize I can tell a computer what to do, I found that to be fascinating.
You had a few odd jobs, you know, as you were growing up. You did fix people's computers.
Yep.
You taught guitar. And the interesting thing, actually, about your guitar is that you wanted to teach guitar, so you learned how to play guitar first so that you could teach it.
Yeah, well, it actually turned out, and I think a lot of teachers would say this, that the best way to learn something is actually to try to teach it. So I started putting up flyers around Scarsdale with little pull-off tabs with my phone number on it, and I quickly learned how to kind of put together a couple of lessons.
You went to Stony Brook for college, and then you pursued a master's at Columbia in computer science. What were some of the jobs that you held after graduating?
Actually, I never really got a job. I had this skill I could program. So even in high school, what I was doing was I was creating little kind of Windows applications. At the time, Windows was the most popular operating system. And if I could create something that people would spend some money on, that was kind of exciting. So I started to look for problems people had. One of those problems were pop-ups, these kind of annoying advertisements that would interfere with your web browsing. The first one was kind of a security and privacy tool. When cookies were starting to become an issue, people were afraid they were being tracked. In the beginning of all these businesses, I would do every part of them. I was a customer service rep. I was the programmer. I was the designer. I did QA.
You also, after college, you tried to start a dating site.
Yeah, there were a whole bunch of different sites that I kind of iterated through. And turns out there was a lot of competition in the dating website world. The website that I created with a few friends didn't take off, so we kind of ditched it pretty quickly.
What was it called?
It was called Particular Personals.
What were some other companies that you kind of tried and failed at or were working on before you launched Shutterstock?
One was a legal services firm that would monitor people's trademarks. That worked for a little while, made some revenue, didn't really go far. But what it would do is it would monitor a trademark that you registered. As other people were registering things that maybe sounded like it or could infringe on it, since as a trademark owner, it's your responsibility to defend those and to find them yourself, this tool would find it for you. Turned out there was a lot of competition in that space too.
What was your parents' view of what you were doing, even before, you know, starting Shutterstock, coding and trying to start internet companies? More than 10, I think you tried.
Yeah, I think they knew that I could be self-sufficient and I would be fine because there was cash coming into my account usually doing something. But they probably didn't quite know what to think. But there were a couple of dynamics going on. I did not want to get a job. In fact, mm-hmm. I was pretty sure I wasn't employable. Mm-hmm. I didn't think I was going to be able to last anywhere even if I got a job.
Did you ever have a conventional job?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I mean, I probably for a couple of days delivered pizza in high school. So I kind of knew deep down I had to figure something else out. I always knew I could fall back on an hourly gig of fixing people's computers. And I also knew that if I needed to get a job as a software developer, I could find that. So that kind of took some risk out of the equation. Mm-hmm. It allowed me to pursue and fail. And so I just kept iterating through everything I could find. I used every website I could find. I used every product I could find. Mm-hmm. I became kind of like an online expert in everything that was being developed out there. What I realized is that when I was marketing all of these products, it was hard to find images.
That was the germ, in a way, for Shutterstock, because, as you're saying, you needed images to go along with the content to make it more appealing to potential customers. And you started to create images yourself. You bought a camera and went out and just shot hundreds of thousands of photographs. At what point were you thinking, you know what, this is going to be yet another business that I'm going to try?
Well, at that point, the pop-up blocker sort of went right out of business because Microsoft built it for free into Internet Explorer, which turned out to be a very successful failure for me because it let me kind of sit back and think about what else I could create. I knew I was interested in photography, but I also knew that as an internet marketer, there was no real resource out there to easily get images. There was this rights managed model where lots of photos were sold under at the time, where you had to tell this calculator where you were going to use the image, how you're using the image, how long you're using the image for, what territory. The internet has no territory. When you put an image out on the internet, the whole world is going to see it. And you can't just pay for the United States, for instance, like you could in the print world. You know, I looked at lots of these stock photo companies and tried to figure out, could I create this content? Mm-hmm. If I spent a whole year just creating content, would I be able to compete with these sites? I bought a digital SLR. I bought a Canon Digital Rebel in 2003. It was one of the first digital SLRs to drop below $1,000. And I would just shoot everything around me. And I iteratively became a stock photographer really quick. I started to put these shots on a website called Shutterstock and charge a one-time fee for them per month. Download whatever you need. And the images actually started to fly off the shelves. I was watching the data that came in on the companies that were buying, and it was companies of all sizes. I realized I wasn't the only one having this mm-hmm. problem. The images I created were not that great. I mean, I was not a good photographer.
What were some of them?
They were the coffee mug that I was drinking out of in the morning. They were people walking down the street. If I found a cool spot to take pictures of New York City, I would go to a roof deck and do that. It was everything I could find around me, including my friends, who I eventually talked into signing model releases.
You mentioned that you were surprised by the response. Was there one or two particular visitors or customers who bought and you thought, oh, wow, Dunkin' Donuts even wants to use this? It lent some credibility to it?
I don't remember too many specifics, but I do remember that I recognized the companies coming in. They were agencies that when I Googled them and I looked up the business, they represented companies that I understood what was going on at that point. The people that were buying my images had no other option.
We mentioned your guitar playing before, and, you know, I thought about, you know, how you learned how to play guitar in order to teach it, just as you learned how to take photos in order to sell them.
I think that's an important part of kind of these businesses that I started, is that I was always the first customer. I was always trying to figure out how to how to get the images that now I was going to try to supply the world with.
You see that demand is higher than you might have thought. What came next?
The demand started to outstrip the supply. I was able to create tens of thousands of images. I realized quickly I needed millions. So if I was able to not be the only contributor and create an open sourced kind of crowdsourced model where anyone could sell, could I do the math here and figure it out? And I settled on 25 images a day. It seemed like at that rate, a single user was able to get everything they needed throughout a month. And then I could back into a calculation where I could pay out 30% of everything that was coming in to contributors. And at that point, I was able to kind of open up the marketplace to both sides.
We take for granted the words like crowdsource. Oh, I crowdsourced it. But, you know, that's not a term that was ubiquitous or well-known in the vernacular in early 2000s. How did you source from the crowd?
I started with online forums. I found these forums of people that were photographers helping each other out to create a better shot. So the kind of idea I had at that point was I contacted a few of them and I said, you guys are creating images just like I am. I'm making this much money off them. Would you like to too? And if you'd like to refer your friends, I'll pay you for the referrals too. So I started to kind of create some influencers. At the time, they were excited about being able to monetize something that they were never able to monetize before.
You have 70,000 contributors. Who were the first one or two? What was their profile?
They were all people that loved photography but had something else as their main job. So they were hobbyist photographers that wanted to get better at doing what they were doing. They wanted to buy that next lens that has always been expensive. This was the thing that they would do the second they left work. That was the profile.
Now, what is the range of income that, you know, a contributor might experience?
Contributors make anywhere from a few dollars a month to hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. There are definitely small businesses that have been created. There are definitely sole proprietors that are making more than they did at their jobs now. Mm-hmm.
What was like a pivot moment for you? I mean, you saw from the inception that there was real demand and you got contributors to buy in. Was there a pivot moment for you where, you know, things started to escalate even more so? Than
The moment that this started to, that I started to realize that this could work was when I was able to get supply in that met demand. Mm. And that's important because the entire marketplace is kind of organically driven, right? And I didn't realize this at first, but what was happening was contributors would come in, they would upload some images, and they would watch what was happening. In real time, they would get paid. They would watch what was getting sold, and then they would create more images like that. And when I started to see that happen, I started to realize that the entire marketplace, what was going to be critical was that I need to keep that connection going because otherwise the contributors are never going to know what the buyers want and vice versa. So there were other agencies that started at the time where this wasn't the case. And it's important that that's there because that's what creates the network effect.
And what was going on with John Oringer, like your personal life at the time while all this is happening?
I was starting to get used to the fact that I wasn't a one-man show anymore and I had to learn how to manage people. Mm-hmm. And that turned out to be pretty difficult. I suddenly went from never working in an office to having a whole group of people that were my employees.
And having to get out of your pajamas if you needed to,
yeah.
Right? I mean, you're at home.
I was working from home. So now I was starting to have an office I would go to every day.
From the get-go, you did not raise venture capital, partly because you didn't need it, or was that wholly because you didn't need it?
It was because I didn't need it. It was also because I didn't know how to get it. It was also because New York was not a place where venture capitalists understood tech companies. So I was able to kind of stay under the radar for many years. and kind of and build this company that was constantly profitable because I had made it really efficient.
And at what point did people start to recognize you as, wow, I mean, they're generating a lot of revenue? You have an IPO in 2012, and 6 months after, you're over $1 billion in market cap. When did the industry start recognizing you, even before the IPO?
Well, photographers also always knew about us, and designers did too, but it's a pretty concentrated world of people. We're a business-to-business product, so we don't show up on consumer screens. By 2008, just about every graphic designer around knew about us. A lot of businesses knew about us. Around 2010 is when people started to notice. And then around 2012 was when we went public, and then there was no going back.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is John Oringer, founder of Shutterstock, a crowdsourced marketplace for photos, illustrations, graphics, video clips, and music. The company has over 50 million images that small businesses, corporations, and other users can purchase at affordable prices. John launched Shutterstock in 2003, and the company went public in fall 2012. John has been called Silicon Alley's first billionaire, meaning that Shutterstock was the first tech company launched in New York City to earn a market cap of above $1 billion. And John's owning more than 50% of the company, thus made you the first new Silicon Alley billionaire. But it's ironic that you took no venture capital, because Silicon Alley is, we think of as, you know, these venture-backed companies.
Yeah, yeah, it is. We did do a private equity round with Insight.
Later.
But in the beginning, I kind of didn't want someone telling me how to run the business. It was always important to me to have complete control over what was going on and be as independent as possible.
You're now in more than 150 countries and in over 20 languages. What cultural dynamics do you recognize? Are there any kind of patterns that you see, let's say, in the Netherlands versus New York versus Japan?
Yeah, we're all over the world. Yeah. And we answer the phones in New York in 20 different languages. And we translated the site into Japanese as the first language. And what happened was we were able to sell images in a country that we didn't have any customer support for, completely self-serve product, just by translating the website. And so once we realized that, we translated the site into 20 different languages from there. The search part of the website is important. And we have a whole team of people trying to make sure that your search is local, your search is relevant to where you're searching from. If someone in Japan searches for food, you want sushi to come up. If someone in the U.S. searches for food, you want hamburger to show up or something relevant.
Do you recognize the site's own images out there in the world?
Yeah. Anywhere from a blog to an online news publication to a billboard would be using our images. Hollywood films use our video.
So what's an example of some films or TV shows? I mean, House of Cards is one. What are some other examples?
With stock video, what you can do is you can use something that may have been hard to create as a transition, for instance. So documentaries tend to use a city time lapse from sunrise to sunset really quickly. So we have every city on Shutterstock, and so documentaries use a lot of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. It's getting more and more popular for websites to use video. Mm-hmm. It's getting more popular for advertising to use video. And it's getting more popular for Hollywood to start using stock video, because we're getting such amazing creative stuff. And it's very well priced.
You're a helicopter pilot. Why are you interested in helicopters?
I've always been interested in helicopters and flying and how they work. And in 2010, I decided to take a helicopter lesson. I always wanted to do it. And I took that lesson and I realized this is something I want to learn. I want to get a license to be able to fly this thing on my own. Mm-hmm. It took a while. It took like a year and a half. I went through kind of the entire training that any helicopter pilot would go through. It took me a little longer because I also have the day job to deal with, but it was awesome and I love it. I still do it up till today.
You're also taking drumming lessons.
I'm always looking for kind of fun things to learn that are outside the scope of what I do every day. Both flying a helicopter and playing drums, they're both They're both super tedious to learn, so you have to put all of your concentration into it. I find that when I'm able to get into something like that, that kind of distraction helps me with the other parts of my job and my life.
Well, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
My guest has been John Orringer. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.